Thank you very much to the organizers for inviting me and for putting together what looks like a great meeting. So I want to start by, since I always forget at the end, acknowledging my collaborators. The work I'm going to talk about today, a lot of it was done by a couple of graduate students in my lab when I was at WashU in St. Louis. All of this is a part of a number of collaborations with Dora Angelaki, who's now at Baylor College of Medicine. A postdoc at Rochester was involved, and Alex Puget was also involved in some parts. Okay, so a fundamental question that interests me, and I suspect many of you as well, is how can we understand the computations that we observe at the level of behavior in terms of the sort of computations that are being done at the level of single neurons and populations of neurons? And I think multisensory integration provides a nice model system in which to address these questions. So at the level of behavior, animals and humans in many contexts will combine information from multiple sensory modalities in order to do tasks. So the owl here might combine visual and auditory information to locate a snack. And it's been shown many times in studies with humans that the perceptual estimate of some stimulus that we care about, when two sources of information are present, say visual and auditory, can often be shown to be consistent with a weighted sum of the perceptual estimates based on the single cues alone. And if the behavior is optimal, then the weights will be inversely proportional to the reliability, be proportional to the reliability of those cues. So if the owl's in complete darkness and the visual information is not very reliable, then there's going to be a very high weight on the auditory input and so forth, okay? And this has been shown many times. Now, at the level of neurons, we know that individual neurons in the brain get input from multiple modalities. And it must be the case that their response to some combination of sensory input is some function of those responses to the individual cues. But what this relationship is hasn't been very clear. But most importantly, what we really want to know is what kind of computation should be done at the level of the single neurons in order for this behavior to turn out the right way and produce optimal performance. Okay, so that's the sort of fundamental question that I want to try to address today. So starting with the neurophysiology, the sort of classic studies of multisensory integration in single neurons have often emphasized nonlinear interactions. And so this is from a review from Barry Stein's lab, and his group has really produced one of the largest bodies of data on this topic from the cat superior colliculus. So here they presented an SC neuron with visual stimulus alone, auditory stimulus alone, and they got a weak response to those stimuli presented by themselves. But when they put them together, they got a big, giant response with an enormous 1,200% facilitation. And it was suggested early on that this might reflect the operation of something like a multiplicative operation, some sort of nonlinearity that's going to really boost up these responses. However, the story gets a little more complicated because it turns out that this interaction depends on the level of the stimulus. So for very weak stimuli, when the individual modality responses are very small, you tend to see these big enhancement effects. But when the same neuron is tested with stronger stimuli, then the multimodal enhancement tends to get weaker. Okay? And so this has been known for a while, but yet the sort of mathematical operations that these neurons are doing have still remained somewhat unclear. Okay, so in contrast to these kind of empirical principles that have been laid out, some theoretical work from Alex's group from several years back showed that neurons can implement Bayes optimal cue integration, and all they need to do in this framework is sum their inputs linearly. Okay, so this piece of theory and the empirical data left us with a number of questions several years back when we got into doing this. First, what is the sort of mathematical rule that cortical neurons use to combine their inputs, and is it generally linear, or is some sort of nonlinearity generally involved? Second, how does this neural combination rule, as I'll call it, depend on the reliability of the sensory inputs. Is it something that's fixed for each neuron, or does it actually change with the intensities of this of the stimulus? Okay, and then finally, can we explain the perceptual weighting of cues according to their reliability, which has been seen many times in human behavior, in terms of how the neurons are actually combining their inputs at the single cell level? All right, so those are the basic set of questions I'm going to try to address today. So we've been tackling this these questions in the context of self-motion perception as a model system. And so as you move through the environment, when you're driving, for example, there is a variety of different cues that give you information about your self-motion. There's visual information in the form of all of the visual objects that stream by in your field of view, produces a pattern of optic flow, which I'll show you in a minute. There's also, of course, vestibular input, because anytime you're accelerating or decelerating or turning, you're gonna stimulate the vestibular organs. There's also somatosensory and proprioceptive input. So if you slam on the brakes, and there's obviously the forces on your body from the seat are going to change and so forth. And there might even be auditory or olfactory or other kinds of cues that could be used to judge which way you're going relative to the environment. So I'm going to focus on visual and vestibular cues because we think that these are by far the two most sensitive cues for the task of judging one's heading. And I'm going to limit this problem to basically straight translational movement. So the variable we care about is heading, and heading is simply your instantaneous direction of translation. Okay, so as I said, it's been known for a long time that the visual system provides a powerful source of input here in the form of optic flow. So if you move forward through the environment, then you get this sort of expanding pattern of retinal image motion, right? And it often has what's called a focus of expansion. And under the simplest set of conditions, if there's nothing moving in the world, and if you're not moving your head or your eyes, then the location of the focus of expansion in the visual field will tell you which direction you're moving in the world. Okay? But in general, this is not the case because we're often moving our eyes and our head, and there's often objects that are moving in the world. So as a result, the pattern of optic flow by itself may not be sufficient in order to estimate heading. Indeed, there are internal signals about eye and head movements that you could potentially use to compensate for those sources of bias, but there aren't any internal signals you can use to deal with object movement. Okay, so this suggests that perceptually you probably want to take advantage of other sources of sensory input that you have, and an obvious other source of input that can help to disambiguate and interpret optic flow is the otolith input from the otolith organs of the vestibular system, which are basically little linear accelerometers and measure the linear acceleration of the head. Okay, so it seemed to us when we started all this that this would be an interesting combination in which to explore these kinds of questions. So the initial goal was to sort of try to understand where and how do neurons in the brain integrate visual and vestibular signals in order to generate robust self-motion perception. Okay, so to do this, we built this sort of virtual reality simulator system for monkeys. And the way this works is that we have an animal sitting in here, and there's a field coil to measure eye movements. There is a display screen here that produces a large field of view image. Images are rear projected by a projector here. And all of this stuff sits on top of a 6-degree of freedom motion platform, which we can use to translate or rotate the monkey around any axis. So the basic idea is that we can then physically move the monkey and show him images of some virtual environment, which we update according to the moment. Okay? So we can then have three basic conditions in these experiments. One that I'll refer to as the vestibular condition is a condition in which the platform moves, but there's no optic flow to give information. The monkey would just be, for example, fixating on a blank screen, and the sides and top of this are all enclosed, so the monkey can only experience visual motion that happen on the display itself. Okay, and then in a visual condition, we can keep the platform stationary, but we can use the visual images to simulate movement through some virtual environment, And of course, we can put these cues together. And importantly, this type of virtual reality makes it easy to decouple these cues and put them in conflict and explore how cue conflicts are going to affect the perception in the neurons, which, as you'll see in a few minutes, I'm going to rely on heavily. Okay, so where would you look in the brain to find neurons that are integrating visual and vestibular inputs that might be useful for this kind of task? And when we started out, there were several possibilities, including areas that are typically considered to be parts of extrastriate visual cortex, like MST and VIP. And there's also other areas that have been called by some vestibular cortex, which are known to get powerful vestibular input. And so it wasn't clear where to start. We've actually, over recent years, done some experiments in all of these areas. And what I can tell you is that, in general, these vestibular cortical areas don't have much response to optic flow, and so they don't seem to be really involved in the types of sensory integration I'm talking about today. But we do find lots of neurons in both MST and VIP that seem to do this. I'm going to focus today on MST, since that's the area that we've by far done the most in. Okay, so MST is, particularly the dorsal subdivision of MST, is an interesting candidate area because the neurons here have very large visual receptive fields. They're often an entire quadrant or even a hemifield. Okay, and it's been known for a long time that these neurons respond to different types of optic flow, and that they're tuned for the location of the focus of expansion in these flow fields. Okay, Ken Britton showed a while back that if you could electrically stimulate MST and you could bias monkeys' judgments of heading that were based solely on optic flow, right, suggesting that there's a causal link between this area and perception of optic flow. And we've much more recently shown that it also is involved in perception of heading from vestibular and visual inputs. And so at the level of individual neurons, MSTD neurons also were known to respond when the animal was translated in darkness, suggesting that was probably due to vestibular inputs. So this seemed like a good place to dig in. So I'm just going to summarize some previous basic results on this before I get onto the main questions. So it turns out that about 60% of the neurons in MSTD are tuned for heading based on both visual and vestibular cues. And about half of these neurons have heading tuning, which is similar for the two cues. So we call these congruent cells, and this is an example of one of these neurons. So here I'm plotting the firing rate of the neuron as a function of heading direction. This is all possible directions in the horizontal plane in this particular experiment. Okay, so zero is forward, rightward, backward, and leftward. And as you can see, these neurons typically have sort of broad, almost cosine-like tuning in the space of possible headings. And they often, as this one does, typically prefer headings either over toward 90 or plus 90, such that they typically have a sort of a broad slope of their tuning curve around forward motion. Okay? And importantly here, you can see that the tuning for visual and vestibular inputs is very similar. Okay? But about half of the multisensory neurons don't behave like this. In fact, we call them opposite cells because typically they have heading preferences that are opposite for the two cues. Okay, so this is a neuron here that responds well when the animal is physically translated to the right, but it responds well when optic flow simulates a translation of the animal to the left. Okay, and I these will come up again later, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that. We don't know for sure yet what these opposite cells do. I can certainly speculate at the end. Okay. So the first major question I want to ask is, what is the mathematical rule by which these neurons combine their visual and vestibular inputs? And how does that combination rule depend on the relative reliabilities of these inputs? Okay? So to do this, we have to have some way to manipulate the relative reliabilities of the inputs. And we did this by manipulating the reliability of the visual cue by adjusting the motion coherence of the stimulus. Okay, so I'll just illustrate that here with a little video. So what you'll see here is four stimuli in sequence. They're all straightforward headings. So you'll see a focus of expansion out from the center. And there's four different motion coherences. So the first one will be zero, and you shouldn't be able to see much of anything in terms of heading, and then the incoherence will increase. Okay, so that's zero, 20%, that's 50%, and 100%. Okay, so as you can see, at 100%, you're able to pretty precisely localize the focus of expansion and estimate the heading. And the more noise you introduce, of course, is going to limit that. Okay. So the first experiment we did to try to get at this mathematical combination rule was sort of a pretty simple brute force experiment. We had eight possible directions of heading in the horizontal plane, shown here. And we could present those either with optic flow alone and measure just the visual heading tuning function here, or we could present vestibular alone and measure the vestibular heading tuning. And then we also presented all 64 combinations of those eight visual and eight vestibular headings. So the data points along the diagonal here are cases where the headings are consistent from the two cues, and all the other ones are conflicts. Okay? This was an experiment just done with a fixating animal. There's no behavioral task here other than maintaining fixation. We'll get to a task later. All right, so here's the result we got when the visual motion was at 100% coherence. And you can see that these bimodal responses are sort of dominated by this kind of horizontal band of response, which is telling you that the visual input is having a bigger weight on that bimodal response than the vestibular input. If we reduce the coherence to 50% in this case, we get a more balanced-looking kind of profile, in which clearly now both inputs are contributing fairly equally. And if we further reduce the coherence to, say, 25%, then the data look more like a vertical band, and it's clear that the vestibular input is dominating the response. So the reason this is useful is that these data now let us ask the question, how can we predict these bimodal responses from the unimodal responses? Okay, and so the simplest possible rule that you could think to apply probably would be a linear weighted sum. Okay, so the bimodal response to all those combinations of headings is going to be some weight times the vestibular plus some other weight times the visual response plus a constant. Okay, so in this case, we're going to use the measured unimodal responses here. And we're just going to fit a regression model to find the weights to best fit the bimodal data. Okay? And then we tried nonlinear models. This is a nonlinear model with a product term, and we tried other nonlinear models as well. I'm not going to show you those because, as you'll see, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. Okay, so now here's some results. So these are that's the data that I showed you previously for the 100% coherence case from that example neuron. And here's the best fit of the linear model, and it's a pretty good fit. If you fit the nonlinear model, then, of course, it's a little bit better fit, and it has to be because you have four parameters instead of three. But in general, as you can see from this graph, we gain very little by adding nonlinearities to a linear model. So what I'm plotting here is the variance accounted for, which is like an R squared, of the nonlinear model against that of the linear model. And on average, the linear model explains about 89% of the variance in the data, and we only gain, on average, about 1% of variance by incorporating a nonlinear. And this was true for other types of nonlinearities we tried as well. Okay? So this suggests that, to first order, these neurons seem to be doing a simple linear-weighted sum of their multisensory inputs. So then we can fit this model separately for each of the different coherences we tested and asked, how do those weights change? And it turns out that the weights do change with coherence. So these are average data from a population of cells, and you can see, and this is plotting the vestibular weight as a function of coherence and the visual weight. And so you can see what happens is that at low coherence, the neuron appears to place more weight on its vestibular inputs, and at high coherence, it appears to place more weight on its visual inputs. Okay? So MSTD neurons appear to change how they weight their visual and vestibular inputs when the relative reliability of the cues changes. Now, this raises some important questions. Is this essentially the right thing for neurons to do? Is this a useful or necessary property in order for a queue integration to work and to be optimal. And you might, at first blush, you might think, yeah, this makes total sense. We know from lots of these human behavioral studies that perceptually we weight inputs differently based on the reliability of the queues, so maybe the neurons need to weight their inputs differently as well. Okay, but in fact, we know from the nice work that Puget's group did that that's not true, that neurons can perform optimal queue integration without changing the weights of their inputs. Okay, if they're Poisson neurons and they have certain properties, then they can just sum their inputs and you'll get perceptual queue weighting without having changes in neural queue weights. Okay, so this left us with a bit of a conundrum to resolve, and this is sort of when we started working more closely with Alex and his group. And it turns out that there's an assumption of the Ma et al. Framework that doesn't really hold for these MSDD neurons. They assumed that some stimulus intensity variable, like coherence, would multiplicatively scale the tuning curves of the neurons. Okay, and that in the math makes it easy to sort of factor out the stimulus intensity variable. But in fact, what MSDD neurons do when you vary coherence is more like this. That is that the tuning curve does scale up, but the baseline tends to shift down. Okay, and this is because a zero coherence stimulus is not no stimulus. It's motion in all directions, and it drives these cells well above their spontaneous activity. And then when you present motion, strong motion in a direction the neuron doesn't like, it actually will respond less. Okay, so it turns out that these neurons violate an assumption of that framework, and so that raised the possibility that with this property, maybe fixed neural weights are no longer the right thing for these neurons to do. Okay, so this is when we set out to try to generalize the theory, and when I say we, I mean Alex. And so what Alex did was he started with our linear weighted sum model, right, which we showed fits the responses well at a particular coherence, and just rearranged this a little bit so that we have this term, which is the ratio of the vestibular and visual weights. And we're now going to assume that those weights can depend on coherence, which is why there's a C in there. And so then the question is, how can we find the ratio of the weights that will achieve optimal integration? And so based on the other properties of a probabilistic population code, Alex was able to derive a formula that gives us the optimal neural Q weight ratio. Okay? And it turns out that this is a rather simple relationship. It says that the optimal ratio of vestibular to visual weights for an individual neuron is related to the slope of its vestibular tuning curve divided by the value of the vestibular tuning curve times the value of the visual tuning curve divided by its slope. So this is kind of like really a ratio of Fisher information for the two cues almost. Okay? So So the nice thing about this is that now we could take our data from our neurons, we could take the tuning curves we measure in the visual and vestibular conditions, and we can make a prediction for how the neuron ought to weight its inputs for each different level of coherence, and then we can compare that with the weight ratios that we could measure by doing the experiment that I just described to you, presenting bimodal responses and fitting the data. Okay, so that's the comparison I'm going to show you here. Okay, so here's the measured ratio of the weights, and here's the optimal ratio computed from the tuning curves. And data are shown here for two different coherences that were used in this particular experiment, 16 and 60%. So there's quite a bit of scatter here. These are noisy measurements pretty intrinsically, especially since we're fixing the range of our stimuli here, so some of these tuning curves are pretty flat over the range of headings tested for some of the neurons. But yet, as you can see, the effect of coherence is very similar on both the measured and the optimal weights, and there's quite a robust correlation between these variables. So this suggests that, to first order, the weight changes that we see in the single neurons are the right things for neurons to be doing, given the structure of their tuning curves and how they depend on the coherence of the stimulus. Okay? It turns out, however, that if you fit a type 2 regression to these data and you measure the slope and the confidence interval, that the relationship here is a little bit steeper than it should be. OK? Okay, so there's a little bit of a suboptimality in how these neurons appear to weight their inputs, and I'll come back to that later. Okay, so let me just kind of summarize the story so far before I go to the last segment. So for a fixed, what I've shown you so far is that for a fixed set of stimulus intensities, MSTD neurons appear to perform a linear weighted sum of their inputs. But if you change the coherence, you change the stimulus intensities, then those best fitting linear weights appear to change. Okay? And these changes in weights are largely predictable from theory of optimal coding if we assume, if we know this, the structure of these tuning curves and how they depend on intensity. Okay? So if all of this is true, then that makes the prediction that we ought to be able to then take the activity of a population of these MSTD neurons and be able to predict the perceptual weighting of the cues in an experiment where the animal has actually got to do that. Okay, so that's what I'm going to tell you about next. All right, so before I do that, just a brief detour into optimal cue integration theory, which I think probably is familiar to most of you. So here's Bayes' rule, which says that the probability of some stimulus given two sources of information, A and B, is the probability of A and B given S times the prior distribution over S and divided by a normalizing term. And of course, if the two cues are independent, then this reduces to being proportional to a product of two likelihood functions based on those two cues. Right? And so graphically, you have a likelihood function for QA and QB, and you take the product of those to get the posterior distribution. Now, one of the predictions this makes that I alluded to at the very beginning of the talk is that the Bayesian theory predicts that the optimal combined estimate is a weighted sum of the single Q estimates where the weights here are inversely proportional to the variances of the Qs. Okay? And these weights are constrained to sum to 1. So graphically, what that means is that if we have two Qs providing information about some stimulus, and there's a discrepancy between those Qs such that the means of these two likelihoods are different, then the combined estimate, if we're optimal, is going to be pulled toward the more reliable Q. That is the Q that has the smaller variance and the tighter distribution. Okay? And so this, as I said, has been done many times in humans, and the predictions of this theory are often found to hold either quite well or at least pretty well. All right, so we tackled this in the context of a heading discrimination task. And the task goes like this. So the monkey starts each trial by fixating a point on the screen, and that point remains head fixed throughout the trial. So the animal's not making any eye movements or head movements during the trial. The animal then gets translated forward with a rightward or leftward component, and at the end of the trial, two targets appear, and he's got to make a choice as to whether he thought he was moving to the right by making a rightward saccade or to the left by making a leftward saccade. Okay, so it's a simple, fine heading discrimination task like many other simple psychophysical tasks. And across trials, we vary the heading direction in small steps around straight ahead and try to find the limit of the animal's performance. Okay, so here's a typical psychometric function for one of our animals in the vestibular condition. Okay, and so what I'm plotting here is the proportion of the times the animal reported rightward motion as a function of the actual heading, where positive values are rightward, negative values are leftward. So you get a nice psychometric function. You can fit this with a cumulative Gaussian, and you can get a psychophysical threshold in normal fashion. If we then present a high coherence visual input, which in this case is 60%, then the performance is better than the vestibular, okay, and you get a threshold about half. And if we present a low coherence, 16% coherence in this case, we get a visual threshold that's lower. So we intentionally chose, in this experiment, two coherences for the visual stimulus, one such that the visual would be better and the other such that it would be worse than the vestibular input in terms of the reliability of the single cues. And from those single cue thresholds, then, you can then use the theory to make a prediction for how the animal ought to weight those inputs. So in this case, based on the thresholds for the high coherence, you'd predict that the animal should give about 20% weight to the vestibular cue and about 80% weight to the visual cue. Okay? And at low coherence, you predict that the animal should give about 80% weight to the vestibular cue and about 20% to the visual cue. All right, so that's the first part of this, is to take the single cue data and try to predict the perceptual weights. And then the second part is to now use cue conflict trials in order to try to actually estimate the animal's perceptual weights when the cues are combined. All right. And so to do this, we present trials in which there's a conflict between the vestibular heading and the visual heading. And that conflict can either be what we call a positive conflict with visual to the right, or a negative conflict with visual to the left. Okay, so the basic intuition here is pretty simple. If we're at a high coherence case where the visual cue is more reliable and we present a positive cue conflict, then the animal's perception should be pulled toward the visual heading, should be pulled toward the right. And if we present a negative cue conflict, then it should be pulled toward the left. But if we're at a low coherence where the vestibular cue is more reliable, then for a positive cue conflict, the percept should be pulled to the left, and for a negative, it should be pulled to the right. Okay, so there should be a predictable relationship of the point of subjective equality of the animal to these cue conflicts. And this is exactly the approach that's been taken many times in human behavior, so I'm not going to go through the details. I'm just going to show you the result. Yeah, so what we do is across trials, we vary the mean heading of those two stimuli for those particular conflicts. Okay? All right, so here's the result. These are behavioral data now from two monkeys. And the orange curve here shows you the predicted vestibular weight. That is the weights predicted from the single cue conditions. And you predict that the vestibular weight should drop as motion coherence increases, as I said before. And these are the animal's actual perceptual weights estimated from the cue conflict trials. And you can see the animal certainly is reweighting the cues. In fact, he's reweighting the cues more than the theory predicts he should. And thus, you have a steeper slope of this green curve. Okay, and so there's some level of suboptimality in the animal's performance here, and I'll come back to that later. All right, and now the other key part of this is to look at the sensitivity or the psychophysical thresholds in the different conditions. So that's what I'm plotting here is thresholds which are normalized to the threshold in the vestibular condition so that we could pool the data across animals. So what you can see here is that the vestibular threshold, of course, doesn't change with coherence since the vestibular stimulus doesn't depend on coherence, but both the visual and combined condition thresholds decline with coherence. The animal gets more sensitive at discriminating heading at high motion coherences, as you'd expect. And importantly, the combined threshold is pretty close to what we would predict from optimal cue integration, which is the white curve. It's a little bit off here at low coherence and less so at high coherence. Okay, so again, there's a little bit of non-optimality, but overall, the animal's behavior is conforming pretty closely to the predictions as shown before. Do I have about 5 minutes now? A little less? Okay, all right. Okay, so I'll try to go more quickly. So these are responses of a neuron that we recorded during the task. Okay, so this is the vestibular tuning curve, the visual tuning curve at high coherence and low coherence. And then we also measure the responses to the cue conflicts. And what happens when we record these individual neuron responses, so this is the response in the combined condition when there's no conflict. That's a positive conflict and a negative conflict. And you basically see some shifting up and down in the responses. And that makes sense here because a positive cue conflict in this case mean at high coherence means that there's more evidence for rightward motion, and this neuron likes leftward motion, so it responds less. But it's hard to relate these raw responses to the behavior. So to do that, we used decoding, and I'm not going to get into the details. Basically, all the results I'm going to show you are from a standard maximum likelihood decoder, but we tried various types of decoders, and all of these results are pretty robust. Okay? So now we can take a look at the behavior and compare that to the results of decoding the MSDD responses. So that's the animal behavior I showed you before. And this is what we get when we decode all of the MSDD neurons together that we recorded. Okay? And you can see that it does predict a cue weighting effect. That's not quite exactly like the behavior, but it's kind of similar. But it fails badly over here in terms of the threshold in the combined condition. As you can see, it predicts that the performance in the combined condition is no better than what you get in the visual condition. And that's because you have a mixture of these congruent and opposite cells, and these opposite cells have opposite tuning slopes, so when you put the two cues together, their tuning curves actually flatten, and they become less sensitive. In fact, you can see that here. If we just decode the opposite cells, then the threshold in the combined condition is actually worse than the thresholds in the single cue conditions. And then we already knew this before. It doesn't make sense to read out these opposite cells for this type of task. But if you selectively decode the congruent cells, then you get a pattern of results very similar to the behavior, both in terms of the Q weights and the sensitivity. Okay, so, and lastly, as I mentioned before, there's a slight suboptimality in these neural weights, and it turns out that if we can predict some of this behavior, this suboptimality level of the decoder from that. So if we take the optimal weight ratio, then of course it predicts weights that match, empirical weights that match the optimal predictions. But if we use the measured weight ratios and generate phony data, we can then get a pattern of results which looks quite like what we get when we decode the real neurons. So what this suggests is that here is that activity of a population of MST neurons can account for the perceptual Q-weighting effects that we see, and deviations from optimality at the level of behavior look like they can be traced, at least in part, all the way back to deviations in how the individual neurons appear to be summing up their inputs. Okay, so I'm going to, since I'm about out of time, I'm going to skip this last section and just tell you really quickly that one big question I haven't answered yet is what mechanism might account for these changes in neural weights. Okay, one possibility is that the synaptic weights of these neurons to visual and vestibular inputs are actually being up and down regulated trial by trial based on some estimates, and that seems very unlikely to us that the system would implement it that way. The other possibility is that there's some sort of network level nonlinearity which might cause this apparent change in weights. And I'm not going to have time to tell you about this, but it turns out that divisive normalization, which is a type of nonlinearity which David Heeger initially proposed to describe V1 neurons and Matteo Carandini has worked on, divisive normalization acting at the level of multisensory integration does a very nice job in explaining those Q-weighting effects as well as a bunch of other phenomena in the empirical literature. All right, so I will jump to the summary. So what I've shown you is that the mathematical operations that MSTD neurons employ can be pretty well approximated by linear summation followed by a divisive normalization. So essentially the same kind of canonical circuit operations that people have invoked to explain low-level sensory processing, things like attention, and so forth, seem to work here quite well. And so if we do a simple decoding of our population, we can account nicely for the Q weighting that we see in perception, including some of the deviations from optimality that we see in the level of behavior. Okay? And this, I think, is a surprising result in the sense that a priori, if I show you some perceptual Q weighting data that's not very optimal, there's lots of reasons it might not be optimal. It could be biases at the level of decision making and other things like that. And what we're saying here is that it seems like some of that may be in the actual neurons itself. Now, it's possible that, harking back to Alex's talk, that what we've got here is the wrong generative model, and there's actually other things that need to be considered in this that would explain why the neurons are a little bit off in how they weight the cues. And they might be optimal factoring other considerations that we don't know at this time. Okay? But anyway, this is a nice, I think, model system provides a nice example of how it's possible to link the computations that are going on at the level of the neurons to the computations that we can observe at the level of behavior. And I think it suggests that even, what I would call moderately complex behavior that involves statistical inference, might be explainable by the same set of kinds of canonical operations that seem to occur over and over in the cortex. Thanks.
Greg, one dimension that you have not touched upon is the time. And in case of visual and vestibular input, and it's known that they have different sensitivity for ongoing stimuli. So wouldn't you expect that the relative weight changes over time if you have like a constant motion going on?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and you're right. So the initial dynamics of the sensory inputs is different for the two systems. In a separate set of studies that we've done with Alex and Jan Drugovitz, we've done human perception of heading in a reaction time context. right? And it turns out that in order to explain those data, you need to model in the time courses of the individual input. So it does look like in a context where, especially where you're measuring the timing of responses, that optimal integration seems to involve knowledge of the underlying time courses of the sensory reliabilities. We don't understand that much about the neural implementation of that yet, but at the level of behavior, that seems to be the case.
Early on in the talk, you mentioned the problems encountered by Stein with multimodal enhancement, that you ramp up by combining stimuli, ramp up in the output nonlinearity, and therefore confuse multiplicative interactions with output nonlinearities. So in principle, the way you have done the experiment is still containing this effect, although you have many more stimuli and therefore you can resolve it much better. As I think you have an online feedback possibility in the setting of your experiment, have you ever tried to run the experiment such that you directly test for the trade-off of visual versus vestibular input by keeping the output constant and varying these two input streams?
What do you mean by keeping the output constant?
Well, you vary vestibular and visual stimuli, you ramp them up and down such that the output of the cell you're focusing on stays constant in a closed loop setting.
No, we certainly haven't tried to do anything. It's an interesting idea.
Then you don't have any effect of the final output nonlinearity because you're operating at fixed output.
Right. So what I can say, and this is part of what I skipped, is that I think this issue of, you know, super additivity and what's going on, I think that's all explained rather simply by just a static output nonlinearity in the model, which is in other types of, like the Heeger divisive normalization model had a squaring output. And we've modeled that, and that seems to explain things rather well. So that static nonlinearity, when in stimuli are very weak, is going to give you that kind of boost. And then normalization is going to produce a saturating nonlinearity, which at high stimuli is going to give you subadditivity. So that simple combination seems to do a pretty good job, at least. Now we're doing some experiments now to try to see if we can actually measure those things in neurons and see if we can, you know, tie that all together. And whether that'll work is not clear. But
okay, and last question here.
Do you have any insights into the computational role of the opposite cells?
Yeah. So the opposite cells. She said, "What's the computational role of the opposite cells?" So short answer is we're not sure. But here's the basic intuition that we have, which I think is likely to be important. The general problem you have of dealing with visual motion and self-motion is sort of a causal inference or source separation problem. So there's some pattern of motion on your retina at any given point in time, and that has two sources. One source is your self-motion combined with the three-dimensional structure of the scene, and the other source is things moving in the world. And it's very important to be able to distinguish, you know, what motion on the retina is due to things moving in the world versus your own self-motion. Okay, so these opposite cells will never be optimally stimulated when you're moving through an environment with all stationary objects. Okay, but if you have something that moves in the environment that generates retinal motion that's not consistent with your self-motion, that would cause these neurons to fire a lot. So we've done some models of this, and we can show nicely in models that the sort of relative activity of congruent and opposite cells can be used, for example, to give you an estimate, a heading, which is very robust to the presence of objects moving in the scene. And in turn, from that, you can get object motion and discount the heading, right? So that's one thing we think is likely to be going on, and we're doing some experiments now to try to test those ideas more directly. But it's too early for me to say anything.
All right, I think we have to stop here because we have to continue at 10:50. So let us thank again Alex and Greg for giving great talks today. Thanks.